Chapter 18. Her lips were quivering, and tears so crowded themselves into her eyes that she could hardly distinguish apples from fern as she continued industriously searching to hide her weakness. As soon as you have finished getting the apples, her aunt said, descending the ladder, come down, and we'll go for the holly. There is nobody on the heath this afternoon, and you need not fear being stared at. We must get some berries, or Clem will never believe in our preparations. Thomason came down when the apples were collected, and together they went through the white palings to the heath beyond. The open hills were airy and clear, and the remote atmosphere appeared, as it often appears on a fine winter day, in distinct planes of illumination independently toned, the rays which lit the nearer tracts of landscape streaming visibly across those further off. A stratum of ensaffroned light was imposed on a stratum of deep blue, and behind these lay still remoter scenes wrapped in frigid gray. They reached the place where the hollies grew, which was in a conical pit, so that the tops of the trees were not much above the general level of the ground. Thomason stepped up into a fork of one of the bushes, as he had done under happier circumstances on many similar occasions, and with a small chopper that they had brought she began to lop off the heavily buried boughs. Don't scratch your face, said her aunt, who stood at the edge of the pit, regarding the girl as she held on amid the glistening green and scarlet masses of the tree. Will you walk with me to meet him this evening? I should like to. Else it would seem as if I had forgotten him, said Thomason, tossing out a bough. Not that that would matter much. I belong to one man. Nothing can alter that. And that man I must marry, for my pride's sake. I am afraid, began Mrs. Eobright. Ah, you think, that weak girl, how is she going, to get a man, to marry her when she chooses? ... but let me tell you one thing, aunt. Mr. Wildev is not a profligate man, any more than I am an improper woman. He has an unfortunate manner, and doesn't try to make people like him, if they don't wish to do it of their own accord. Thomason, said Mrs. Eobright quietly, fixing her eye upon her niece, do you think you deceive me in your defense of Mr. Wildev? How do you mean? I have long had a suspicion that your love for him has changed its color since you have found him not to be the saint you thought him, and that you act a part to me. He wished to marry me, and I wish to marry him. Now, I put it to you. Would you at this present moment agree to be his wife, if that had not happened to entangle you with him? Thomason looked into the tree, and appeared much disturbed. And, she said presently, I have, I think, a right to refuse to answer that question. Yes, you have. You may think what you choose. I have never implied to you by word or deed that I have grown to think otherwise of him, and I never will. And I shall marry him. Well, wait till he repeats his offer. I think he may do it, now that he knows something I told him. I don't for a moment dispute that it is the most proper thing for you to marry him. Much as I have objected to him in bygone days, I agree with you now, you may be sure. It is the only way out of a false position, and a very galling one. What did you tell him? That he was standing in the way of another lover of yours. Aunt, said Thomason, with round eyes, what do you mean? Don't be alarmed, it was my duty. I can say no more about it now, but when it is over I will tell you exactly what I said, and why I said it. Thomason was perforce content. And you will keep the secret of my would-be marriage from Clem for the present? She next asked. I have given my word to. But what is the use of it? He must soon know what has happened. A mere look at your face will show him that something is wrong. Thomason turned and regarded her aunt from the tree. Now, hearken to me, she said, her delicate voice expanding into firmness by a force which was other than physical. Tell him nothing. If he finds out that I am not worthy to be his cousin, let him. But, since he loved me once, we will not pain him by telling him my trouble too soon. The air is full of the story, I know, but gossips will not dare to speak of it to him for the first few days. His closeness to me is the very thing that will hinder the tail from reaching him early. If I am not made safe from sneers in a week or two, I will tell him myself. The earnestness with which Thomason spoke prevented further objections. Her aunt simply said, "Very well. He should by rights have been told at the time that the wedding was going to be. He will never forgive you for your secrecy." "Yes, he will, when he knows it was because I wished to spare him, and that I did not expect him home so soon. And you must not let me stand in the way of your Christmas party. Putting it off would only make matters worse." "Of course I shall not. I do not wish to show myself beaten before all Egdon, and the sport of a man like Wildev. We have enough berries now, I think, and we had better take them home. By the time we have decked the house with this and hung up the mistletoe, we must think of starting to meet him." Thomason came out of the tree, shook from her hair and dressed the loose berries which had fallen thereon, and went down the hill with her aunt, each woman bearing half the gathered boughs. It was now nearly 4 o'clock, and the sunlight was leaving the veils. When the west grew red, the two relatives came again from the house, and plunged into the heath in a different direction from the first, towards a point in the distant highway along which the expected man was to return. Three, how a little sound produced a great dream. Eustacia stood just within the heath, straining her eyes in the direction of Mrs. Eobright's house and premises. No light, sound, or movement was perceptible there. The evening was chilly, the spot was dark and lonely. She inferred that the guest had not yet come, and after lingering 10 or 15 minutes she turned again towards home. As he had not far retraced her steps, when sounds in front of her beckoned the approach of persons in conversation along the same path. Soon their heads became visible against the sky. They were walking slowly, and though it was too dark for much discovery of character from aspect, the gait of them showed that they were not workers on the heath. Eustacia stepped a little out of the foot track to let them pass. They were two women and a man, and the voices of the women were those of Mrs. Eobright and Thomason. They went by her, and at the moment of passing appeared to discern her dusky form. There came to her ears in a masculine voice, "Good night." She murmured a reply, glided by them, and turned round. She could not, for a moment, believe that chance, unrequested, had brought into her presence the soul of the house as he had gone to inspect, the man without whom her inspection would not have been thought of. She strained her eyes to see him, but was unable. Such was her intentness, however, that it seemed as if her ears were performing the functions of seeing as well as hearing. This extension of power can almost be believed in at such moments. The deaf Dr. Kiddo was probably under the influence of a parallel fancy when he described his body as having become, by long endeavor, so sensitive to vibrations that he had gained the power of perceiving by it as by ears. She could follow every word that the ramblers uttered. They were talking no secrets. They were merely indulging in the ordinary vivacious chat of relatives who have long been parted in person, though not in soul. But it was not to the words that Eustacia listened. She could not even have recalled, a few minutes later, what the words were. It was to the alternating voice that gave out about 1/10 of them the voice that had wished her good night. Sometimes this throat uttered yes, sometimes it uttered no. Sometimes it made inquiries about a time-worn denizen of the place. Once it surprised her notions by remarking upon the friendliness and geniality written in the faces of the hills around. The three voices passed on, and decayed and died out upon her ear. Thus much had been granted her, and all besides withheld. No event could have been more exciting. During the greater part of the afternoon, as he had been entrancing herself by imagining the fascination which must attend a man come direct from beautiful Paris laden with its atmosphere, familiar with its charms. And this man had greeted her. With the departure of the figures, the profuse articulations of the women wasted away from her memory, but the accents of the other stayed on. Was there anything in the voice of Mrs. Eobright's son for Clement was startling as a sound? No, it was simply comprehensive. All emotional things were possible to the speaker of that ood night. Eustacia's imagination supplied the rest except the solution to one riddle. What could the tastes of that man be who saw friendliness and geniality in these shaggy hills? On such occasions as this, a thousand ideas pass through a highly charged woman's head, and they indicate themselves on her face. But the changes, though actual, are minute. Eustacia's features went through a rhythmical succession of them. She glowed. Remembering the mendacity of the imagination, she flagged. Then she freshened. Then she fired. Then she cooled again. It was a cycle of aspects, produced by a cycle of visions. Eustacia entered her own house. She was excited. Her grandfather was enjoying himself over the fire, raking about the ashes and exposing the red-hot surface of the turves, so that their lurid glare radiated the chimney corner with the hues of a furnace. "Why is it that we are never friendly with the Eobrites?" she said, coming forward and stretching her soft hands over the warmth. "Wish we were. They seem to be very nice people." "Be hanged if I know why," said the captain. Liked the old man well enough, though he was as rough as a hedge. "But you would never have cared to go there, even if you might have, I am well sure." "Why shouldn't I?" "Your town tastes would find them far too countrified. They sit in the kitchen, drink meat and elder wine, and sand the floor to keep it clean. A sensible way of life. But how would you like it?" "I thought Mrs. Eobright was a ladylike woman? A curate's daughter, was she not?" "Yes, but she was obliged to live as her husband did, and I suppose as he has taken kindly to it by this time. Ah, I recollect that I once accidentally offended her, and I have never seen her since." That night was an eventful one to Eustacia's brain, and one which she hardly ever forgot. She dreamt a dream, and few human beings, from Nebuchadnezzar to the Swaffham Tinker, ever dreamt a more remarkable one. Such an elaborately developed, perplexing, exciting dream was certainly never dreamed by a girl in Eustacia's situation before. It had as many ramifications as the Cretan labyrinth, as many fluctuations as the northern lights, as much color as a parter in June, and was as crowded with figures as a coronation. To Queen Scheherazade the dream might have seemed not far removed from commonplace, and to a girl just returned from all the courts of Europe it might have seemed not more than interesting. But amid the circumstances of Eustacia's life it was as wonderful as a dream could be. There was, however, gradually evolved from its transformation scenes a less extravagant episode, in which the heath dimly appeared behind the general brilliancy of the action. She was dancing to wondrous music, and her partner was the man in silver armor who had accompanied her through the previous fantastic changes, the visor of his helmet being closed. The mazes of the dance were ecstatic. Soft whispering came into her ear from under the radiant helmet, and she felt like a woman in paradise. Suddenly these two wheeled out from the mass of dancers, dived into one of the pools of the heath, and came out somewhere into an iridescent hollow, arched with rainbows. "It must be here," said the voice by her side, and blushingly looking up she saw him removing his casque to kiss her. At that moment there was a cracking noise, and his figure fell into fragments like a pack of cards. She cried aloud. That I had seen his face. Eustacia awoke. The cracking had been that of the window shutter downstairs, which the maidservant was opening to let in the day, now slowly increasing to nature's meager allowance at this sickly time of the year. "Oh, that I had seen his face," she said again. "'Twas meant for Mr. Eobright." Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.